pricing your round. So what are some things that you think about? What are some building blocks to get to how much money should the startup be raising? And what should the valuation be? And even, for the hell of it, priced round, post-money safe, convertible note, what are the considerations? And maybe we talk about pre-revenue fundraising, and then get into anywhere from 5K to 100K of monthly recurring revenue type stage. And then we're going to address Series A. How should people start thinking about these things?
And so Series A is where I spend most of my time since that's what I do to help my companies. And the very earliest pre-revenue, that's, not an area that I spend a bunch of time on. I see the pre-revenue ones, those are depending on the team and the location and the da-da-da-da, those are 5 to 10 million on a safe note. If you're raising, and the advice I give to my friends who are starting companies, if you're raising a modest amount of money relative to the valuation, then don't get wrapped around the axle with respect to the valuation. I mean, yes, if you're raising 3 million, then there's a big difference between 5 and 10 million valuation. But if you're raising 300K, it doesn't matter that
Yeah,
much,
that's
right?
right.
I mean, in one case you own 5 divided by 5.3, and the other one you own 10 divided by 10.3. It's not that big a difference, and the ability to be able to raise the capital is wildly different at the lower end than at the higher end. Now, if you're raising a big amount of capital, then it does matter.
Hello and welcome to Fireside with the VC. My name is Andrew Romans, and I'm with my old and really great friend Eric Verplu. Eric actually was in the same building as me, although before I was there. I think, weren't you at Bay Hill Drive in San Bruno?
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. So what Vantage Point? I think it was VP.VC or .com or something like that. Vantage Point.
I tried to get the URL so that I could be Verplu Venture Partners, but they wouldn't give it up.
Oh, really? Isn't Vantage Point? Is Vantage Point? I thought it kind of.
Well, they changed it to Vantage Point Capital Partners, and then they're still running. Yeah, they're still using the old domain too.
Yeah. So I think it's good to work with people that have a lot of experience. Eric, for his very youthful young age, has really been in the VC game for a long time, going back to Vantage Point and a few others. And we've been in close contact even long before you founded Tinnitus Ventures, right? So it's Tinnitus Ventures, which is right around the corner from where I used to live, Tinnitus Creek. For those of you who enjoy cycling or biking or hiking in Redwoods in the Bay Area with a glimpse of the Pacific Ocean, just magical stuff. But today we're really going to do, rather than just talk about how great we are, that we're the two greatest VCs in the world.
I mean, Andrew and I are pretty much the best.
Yeah. No egos here. We're going to get a deep dive into valuations. So we're going to talk about valuations. How much money should the company be raising? How is that kind of determined? How are valuations determined? What's the right thing to do? What's the wrong thing to do? What are reoccurring mistakes that we've seen? Eric has actually been an active VC for so many years. He probably knows how this Kung Fu movie is going to end because he's seen a few of them before. So why don't we dive into all that? But Eric, give us a quick background on your career before we start getting into our thoughts on these little exciting topics.
Sounds great. So I grew up in the Midwest, was an engineer, undergrad, came out to Stanford, got my PhD in electrical engineering, loved it, stayed, got my MBA at Stanford as well. Then started 2 venture-backed companies, raised 5 rounds of venture from great venture firms, Kleiner Perkins, JMI, Vantage Point, others, Mayfield. And then spent 8 years at Vantage Point Venture Partners, and then 3 years at another large venture firm. And then in the middle, did a whole bunch of my own seed stage investing and looked at the things that I enjoyed most and where I was producing the best returns. And it was absolutely my 8x gross returns on my own personal seed stage investing. And so I decided to launch a firm to do just that. So I launched Tinnitus a year and a half ago, and my primary source of differentiation in an awesome ecosystem of seed investors is I help my companies raise their next round of funding.
Right.
So I focus a lot on what's currently happening in the Series A landscape and how to help those companies be successful in raising Series A.
Okay. And you've even been doing research on like graduation rates in the Bay Area versus non-Bay Area. I'm actually really curious to jump right into that. I'm kind of impatient to hear what the data says. So graduation rate is something that VCs like Eric and I are very proud of, because when we fund a company, one of the reasons why I've enjoyed being so active in big evolved ecosystems like Silicon Valley, San Francisco Bay Area, New York City, where we've had offices for the last couple of decades, is that we know so many VCs to introduce you to, that if the first 100 say no, we got another 100 waiting. If they say no, we got another 100 waiting. We're, you know, the number one cause of death is running out of cash. And a good way to do that is either get money from customers. Another way to do that is get money from some investor. So graduation rates mean Eric invests from Tanita Ventures into a startup. And what is the graduation rate? What percentage of his portfolio companies graduate with raising a bigger check from a bigger, from another fund that's legit? So you probably have, I'm guessing you have like a near 100% graduation rate for your own investments.
So for my seed stage investing, I'm at not 100%, but well above 80%.
Yeah.
And the part that I'm particularly proud of is that I'm, what's the exact number? North of 40% from top tier Series A firms, so top 10 Series A firms. And that, you know, that's no guarantee of success, but it increases the chances of success when you have really great investors, you know, leading the
Okay. Series. So with graduation rates, are you talking graduate to a Series A, or are you defining that? That's how you're defining it. So what is the research? What did your research tell you? Can you share that with us for Bay Area versus non-Bay, or how do you break it up?
Yeah, so I recently, and I'm about to publish this blog post, that I looked at how it's evolved through COVID. So I took 3 1-year cohorts, 1 year before COVID, 1 year after COVID, and then the year after that. So, you know, 13 to 24 months after the onset of COVID. And I said, look at the companies that raised their first $1 million of seed funding in that cohort, in those three cohorts, in the San Francisco Bay Area, so the 9 counties that touch the San Francisco Bay Area, and then the rest of the United States. And you look and say, okay, what fraction of those go on to raise Series A within 22 months of the end of the cohort? And the reason it's 22 months and why I picked that date is it ends last month for the most recent cohort. So it's as far out into the future as I could go, but I use the same definition of what the Series A graduation period was for all the three cohorts would be fair. And what you see is, well, one big takeaway is graduation rates have gone way down recently, right? As the fundraising environment has gotten painful, we see just across the whole country that graduation rates have gone down. The thing that was interesting to me, and that I've been waiting for most of my professional career, is to see the rest of the ecosystem catch up with the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, it's been an advantage, and it's clearly an advantage to be in the Bay Area. And I've been waiting, I don't know, for a decade and a half for it to catch up. And what I see in the data stubbornly, persistently, is that every time I look, it just gets a little bit better to start your company in the San Francisco Bay Area. So looking at the specifics at these three cohorts, we say of the companies that raised their seed round, their first million of seed round in the cohort, what percent went on to raise Series A? And we take the ratio of San Francisco Bay Area versus the rest of the United States. In the period before COVID, that ratio was 1.4x. So you were 1.4x more likely to go raise Series A if you were in the San Francisco Bay Area than if you were in the rest of the US. Then in the next cohort, where you could, I mean, this was the beginning of remote work from anywhere, you know, this was going to be the great democratizing force. And what we saw is that 1.40x went to 1.50x. And so it actually became more advantaged to be in the San Francisco Bay Area, at least from the measure of raising Series A.
And trying to understand, like, this is kind of Dexter reading the blood smattering and figuring out, was he, you know, right-handed stab wound, or, you know, what's behind that? It may be that in the cohort kind of following COVID, we were in this frothy, spicy market where every soccer mom in the Midwest that was anti-e-commerce was buying. She was going to Target.com and buying her vacuum cleaner as opposed to going in the store. So, like, everyone was adopting the Silicon Valley digitization, you know, great time to start a podcast, everything digital that you were never doing. And then the valuations went up. And so I think that the market just maybe got really frothy in concentrated Silicon Valley, of people were just making a lot more investments. So Silicon Valley was, you know, due diligence was out of fashion. People were cutting checks fast and furiously during that time. And so if you were near that action, you know, the percent, the multiple went up, where I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out, why would that be?
So the funny part. So the underlying causality, I think, is a very difficult one to pin down. Right.
Yeah.
It is, I think that conjecture is an interesting one. I think you could make, you know, other conjectures around, you know, you could make a long list, right? I mean, the classic ones have been, hey, this is where the money is. Hey, this is where the entrepreneurs or the next level of management as you scale up a company is. This is where the companies that are willing to do the crazy, you know, idea that nobody else thinks is a good one are. And I don't know that that's knowable, candor.
I mean, having raised my children in the Bay Area, I was coaching part-time their lacrosse team, and the other dads and moms that were there were like either buying my portfolio companies, investing in my VC fund, or they were VCs. I mean, so just literally a couple hours on the lacrosse field in San Mateo or whatever, Menlo Park, were literally like, people have heard of my companies,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so they're, you know, so my portfolio is getting introduced to their next investor through just physically being alive there.
Yeah, I think there's a huge agglomeration economy benefit like you're talking about. But I also think there's, I forget who the pundit was that first said this, it wasn't me, that said, it's better for your reputation to fail conventionally than to succeed unconventionally. And that here in the Silicon Valley Bay and broader San Francisco Bay Area, startups are conventional. And so it's okay to fail at a startup here. Whereas, you know, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. If you started a company and failed, like, you're a loser. And so I think there's a because it's what everybody's doing, no one sees it as you're taking this crazy risk. That's, anyway, one of my pet theories on why the advantage of the Bay Area keeps increasing is that you just have a higher concentration of people for whom this is conventional accepted behavior.
Okay. And so in the third cohort, then?
Here's the punchline. So then in the next cohort, which is fundraising in the 22 months, you're raising their Series A in the 22 months that ended 14 days ago, the graduation ratio went up. Again, the advantage of the Bay Area. It went from 1.50 to 1.52 times as likely that you would raise Series A if you were based in the Bay Area.
So did graduation rates across the board decrease during that time? So,
yeah, way down across the whole country.
So it became harder to graduate, period. And if you were living in low density of venture capital, and all the network that networks you to the venture capital, then moving to Montana got even harder.
The increase was very slight. So, you know, it's not within statistical noise. It was pretty much the same as the previous cohort, but the previous cohort changed from the year before COVID to the year after COVID, the statistically significant increase in the probability of success. And then in the year after, the number went up. I would say from a statistically significant perspective, it was flat to last in terms of the relative advantage that you had being in the Bay Area.
So Vantage Point was I think your first official VC role, right? Was that 97? When did you get started with them?
I'm not that old. Let's see. I was there 2001 through 08. So 8 years.
Oh, wow. Wow. What a vintage 2001. That's like come to mama with the valuation. So what were seed valuations like? Do you remember? And I know this because I was a founder. What would a pre-revenue company be raising at back in those dark days of Sarbanes-Oxley .com crash implosion recovery?
Yeah, I mean, that was pre-Sarbanes-Oxley. I remember raising my Series A with Kleiner Perkins and JMI, leading my Series A. We'd raised 100K of angel money, from the Arriaga family, right? And that was a little unusual that you would even have done that. There wasn't as robust a seed infrastructure in place in the 90s. It was a lot of times you just went straight to Series A. Like, that was the first round. That's why it's called Series A.
Yeah, well, you needed to buy a $50,000 SunSpark. You needed to create your own node of the internet. Like, your IP address was in your closet, Yes. So you had to get an Oracle license that was, horribly expensive.
You had to buy a phone system. You had to, like, all of that stuff. It was a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, PBX. I remember, like, a lot of time on the goddamn PBX. And I was, like, Mr. Software Switch, soft switch guy. And I'm like, this whole thing is going to be this whole thing's going to be a doorstop. Just give it a little bit of time. That's right. That's right.
It took a long time before those became obsolete. But, I mean, it just seems crazy to talk about it today. But that was a lot of money and time and effort. And it used to be you'd have to get a phone number at your office and you had to wait for the phone company to issue the number. And, I mean, and getting the internet connection, it wasn't there
DIDs.
Already. It was just all of this.
Well, so you needed kind of $5 million to make a website, you needed $5 million to make a website. So that was kind of a Series A, but the point I was driving at is that you're more active in raw seed than I am now these days. We're getting more into late seed as an entry point. That's why we make such good friends, but it seems like the seed valuations got major inflation, like, people running around raising money on these post money safes at 30 million and they don't have any revenue. It seems like the math doesn't work anymore. Like, if you're going to get in that early and have to wait so long and there's going to be a higher death rate, depends how much diversification, if you're going to like Ron and Conway your way into it or have more of a concentrated portfolio where you're truly doing a lot of work for your portfolio like you. What have you seen change over the decades in seed valuation? And then let's talk about what makes sense now.
I think it's kind of lunacy at the early stage that what you're talking about is absolutely the case, that the valuations are very high. They have not come down much in the relative, crash would be an overstatement, but correction, in the last year and a half,
right,
where they have come down precipitously in the later stages.
Right.
My view in that kind of environment, that is, if you're going to pay those kinds of prices, then you need to be in the companies where they've started to show the unit economic model is really working. And so I have not made any pre-revenue investments because the change in valuation between super risky and unproven and who knows whether there's a thing here,
yeah,
pre-revenue kind of case, versus the case where they have a million ARR. But yeah, it's higher, but it's not, it's nowhere near as much higher as the increased view into the possibility of this being an outlier. And I want to be really, really purposeful about the way that I say that it's not about reducing the risk of it failing. It's more the visibility into this being an outlier home run that I'm excited about in that subset of companies. And I'm happy to pay the higher valuation if I see a higher probability of the company being one of those very few potential home runs that generate most of the profit in our industry.
Yeah. 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 So why don't we talk about pricing your round? So what are some things that you think about? What are some building blocks to get to? How much money should the startup be raising? and what should the valuation be? And even, you know, for the hell of it, priced round, post money safe, convertible note, what are the considerations? And maybe we talk about pre-revenue fundraising, and then get into anywhere from 5K to 100K of monthly recurring revenue type stage. And then we're going to address Series A. You know, how should people start thinking about these things?
And so Series A is where I spend most of my time, since that's what I do to help my companies. And the very earliest pre-revenue, that's, you know, not an area that I spend a bunch of time on. I see the pre-revenue ones, you know, those are, depending on the team and the location and the da-da-da-da, you know, those are 5 to 10 million on a safe note. And, you know, if you're raising, and the advice I give to my friends who are starting companies, if you're raising a modest amount of money relative to the valuation, then don't get wrapped around the axle with respect to the valuation. I mean, yes, if you're raising 3 million, then there's a big difference between 5 and 10 million valuation.
Right.
But if you're raising 300K, it doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, you know, in one case you own 5 divided by 5.3, and the other one you own 10 divided by 10.3. It's not that big a difference. And, you know, the ability to be able to raise the capital is wildly different at the lower end than at the higher end. Now, if you're raising a big amount of capital, then it does matter.
I tell people when you're trying to figure out these decisions on the seed side, which is earlier than we get involved, but, you know, I try to be good karma guy of doing people as much favors as possible so that when they enter our Goldilocks sweet spot, they're ready to, you know, take our money and bring you in if we say you're the greatest. But is that you don't want to have too much dead weight in the cap table going into a Series A. So let's call all the shares, the percentage of your company that's owned by investors, let's just happily call them all dead weight. Like, yeah, they're supposed to add value, but they're not all Eric's here. So if you've sold too much of your company going into a Series A, benchmark is like, well, this doesn't look like a benchmark deal. I mean, Christ, you've already sold 70% of the company. If we invest, we're going to introduce you. There's going to be many more financings. We need to have equity to attract and retain talent here. That's one thing. And on the other hand, you want to make it attractive. So you don't want to be raising money at such a low valuation and getting meaningful dilution that you fall into this dangerous area. And yet you want to make it attractive to get it done. And it's good to know where the market is, of course, of how you compare to other guys.
And if you're doing, you know, a software, SaaS-y, you know, kind of business, you don't need that much capital usually for that to be a big concern. Now, if you pivot a second time or a third time and, you know, your founder walked away or co-founder, then those kinds of dead weight on the cap table become a big issue. But if things have gone, you know, reasonably smoothly and your software, then that's rarely an issue. Now, if you're moving atoms around, right, like, you know, you're going to launch a satellite and you're going to do, then those kinds of issues can be really, you know, a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then go ahead.
I don't disparage the just a check writing kind of firm either, right? I mean, that fills an important role in the ecosystem. And as long as they're not saying they're going to do a whole lot and then, you know, fail to live up to the promise, if they say, hey, I'm just going to write you a $100,000 check and call me if you need anything, well, then fine, right? I mean, you know, they probably have a quick, fast, you know, diligence process, and you got the money, and that allows you to operate. I don't think that's inherently good or bad, as long as they're living up to, you know, what they say they're going to do.
Right. And so what are some thoughts you have on how to advise a company? Maybe we're getting a bit later stage, like late seed, you know, where we like to invest, and I think you do too, and then going into Series A's. What are some thoughts around how to figure out how much money should we raise?
So there are, I think, two parts of answering the question at that sort of, you know, late seed Series A. One of them is sort of the exogenous environment, and then the other part is endogenous, you know, the stuff that you can control. And a mistake I see happen very frequently is the entrepreneur will say, well, I know a guy who in a category with a company nowhere near as good as mine, who just raised $20 million at this really luscious valuation. So I'm going to go do the same thing. Or they say, well, I read that median Series A is $13.5 million and they take 20% of your company. I just thought of the hack. We'll say we're going to raise $70 million and they'll still take 20% of the company. And see how, what a genius I am. And, it doesn't work that way. the reality is, let me go for the constructive part first. The constructive part is start with your needs, right? So how much capital do you need to get what done? What are the big either validating or risk reducing milestones you can get done with what amount of capital? And, and if it's a continuum, some rough rules of thumb, 18 additional months of runway, increase your key KPIs by 3 to 5x between Series A and Series B. How much cash is that going to take? 2 to 4 times as much cash as you've raised already. None of these are sort of like, oh, this is how to do it. But there are, sort of sanity checks in that process. But it's not like you do that in isolation. You are living in a world where the exogenous environment matters. It has gotten harder to raise money. A lot of times the answer is, well, rather than going and trying to raise a $15 million Series A, why don't you just pick up $2 or $3 million of additional seed money and add another 6 months onto your existing runway because you're about to get to this value inflection point or pass through some hurdle that you believe will make Series A a lot easier to get done. And so I see that happen a lot is rather than going in and doing a difficult Series A, they will pick up some additional seed money.
We made an investment into a Palo Alto company years and years ago. We introduced them to a guy we both know who's at a CVC, and then they became the biggest customer. So the company was like, had a bunch of trials. All of a sudden they got $5 million of quarterly revenue out of the corporate that we had introduced them to, who did invest in the company. So that all of a sudden they're at like a $20 million run rate. And some of the people were saying, oh, well, let's go raise $50 million on a pre of 150. And I was saying, well, if you have a post of $200 million, the new investors are probably going to be blocking and rejecting a sale of the company that's less than 4x that post. So, we've got to sell the company for practically $1 billion in order to satisfy guys coming in on that 50 on 150 with a 200 post. If we raise 10 on 40, so if you raise 10 million on a pre of 40, that actually gives the company 24-month cash runway easily with funding a team to get shit done. And if you sold the company for 200 million, that's 4xing the 50 million post. And let's talk to some of my LPs that are sell-side M&A bankers in the Valley and New York. If you had the mandate to sell this company in the future, how many companies would you take it to as prospective buyers? Like, what does the list look? What's the constellation of would-be buyers for this company when we could accept, if we had to, a $200 million sale of the company compared to who's on the list if we've got to exit for $1 billion or $800 million? And they're like, woof. I prefer this deal. If I could sell it for 200, I mean, I'd like to get $1 billion. Obviously I'm incentivized to, but those are considerations. And another one too, is that the guy who can raise that $120 million pre-money valuation for his like 2021 deal, that isn't really, there's no sanity remote multiple of this revenue, that your next round is at risk. So if you raise it too high a valuation on this round, what is the next funding round going to look like? And are you at risk of facing a flat or down round as a result of, you raised it this? And then what is dilution? What are you going to own in this business in the end as the founder anyway? Is there what's the percentage difference if you go from like a $40 million pre to a $12 million pre, and how much money you need? And then the next round, you're kind of putting the whole farm at risk by going after inflated valuations. And sometimes the existing VCs, guys that I really respect, are pushing, they're the ones pushing for a crazy up round to put points on the board for their little TVPI or something?
You know, we're all creatures of the environment we're in. And, you know, in 2021, you know, it felt like the trees would grow to the moon. And sure, those of us who are old and have seen, you know, that trees don't always grow all the way up to the moon, knew better. But that, you know, is it bad to raise money at a higher valuation? Yeah, there's going to be some pain if there's a down round. But the mechanics, and as long as you didn't agree to something egregious, right? And so, you know, if you're smart and in a frothy environment like that, well, rather than raising 50 at 150 and giving them blocking rights, why don't we trade the blocking rights for, I don't know, 20 million off on the valuation? And they're like 50 at 120, or maybe 40 at 120, no blocking rights. And they're like, yeah, trees are going to go to the sky. That sounds great. And then you've done the right thing for the company. You don't want to paint yourself in the corner, and you don't want to assume that good times will last forever. But down rounds, I mean, you know, people, you know, it's not good for anybody's ego, and you know, people don't like to hear that. But if you raised at a big valuation in 21 and you're doing a down round now, it's not like everyone's like, oh my gosh, I've never heard of that. You know, it's happening. It's 20% of all financings, you know, that are happening, you know, post Series A are down rounds.
Yeah.
So, you know, as long as you didn't agree to something punitive in the last time, you know, you work through the mechanics of how the down round, you know, flows through your cap table. And it's usually not that bad. I mean, it's nothing to write home about, but it's usually not that bad. You don't, what I always say, whether I'm already an investor or I'm a prospective investor, is just take the lower valuation. Don't try to prop up your old inflated 2021 valuation and put structure in, right? A guaranteed return, a multiple, you know, like all of these things, all of those blocking rights, all of those things that you know, sound like just words that the lawyers are saying, those things can paint you into a corner 24 months down the road and really put the company at jeopardy. And a lot of those can be, you know, the term sheet that's written by the sophisticated, you know, later stage investor, it's sort of heads, we all win together, tails, I get my preferred return and you get zero.
Yeah. I think simplified terms with a lower valuation are in general a better way forward for all stakeholders than super complicated structuring that just to pump up a dumb valuation, which was dumb when it happened, and it's more obviously dumb now. Go ahead.
It was like the flow of capital was there, right? The Fed hadn't increased, you know, rates. The Fed increased rates. That makes the cost of capital higher. I mean, it's not like we were stupid, you know, to be deploying capital in 21. It's that things changed and now capital hurdle is higher. I don't think so much that like the market takes leave of its senses and then becomes sane again. I mean, we're always swinging in a pendulum one way or another based on the environment around us. You know, those with longer views, you know, have a sense that like you take advantage of the good times and you try not to paint yourself into a bad corner in the bad times.
I thought things were a bit crazy in 2021. And if anything, we started investing later in later stage deals where like the multiple, if you divide the pre-money valuation by the ARR now, not forward, not past, it was a lot more sane than what was going on there. I knew that the stock market wouldn't continue to do this by the time that we were exiting. So, we, there's a big delay between entry point and exit. And so I just thought there's no way the stock market's going to be like this when we exit. And so I thought it was crazy. You mentioned 18-month runway. Just what are your thoughts around general ideas around runways, maybe even for different types of companies in different industries? You know, how you don't want to sell too much stock when it's cheap. You want to grow the value and sell more stock when it's at a higher valuation, but you also don't want to have too short a runway that you're straight back out trying to raise capital as opposed to building your business. It is a distraction from the founders to be talking to VCs intensely when doing a round. What are your views on how many months runway do you like to see your portfolio companies have at the time that you enter yourself? And what do you think the industry thinks about that?
I think there's a pretty significant demark between priced rounds and unpriced rounds. And that when they're doing seed funding, you know, you can kind of roll and close those as you go. You know, it's not, there's not a single closing point and a lead and a contracted set of terms. You've got a safe note, you're bringing other people on into the safe note, you make some progress, maybe you increase the, you know, there's a new safe note, it's got a higher cap, and you can kind of do that in drips and drabs. But when it gets to a priced round where like there's a lead and there's a set of documents and you spend money with the lawyers to create the full set of documents, well, that is a distraction. And it can happen, it only happens at a close, right? It happens at a single point in time and requires a process to orchestrate up to that point in time. And that's a much bigger distraction than sort of the rolling close of throwing some more people onto your safe note. So I think the advice is very different in those two cases. In the first case, it's kind of like, just take the money as you find, you know, people you want to work with. In the second case, then I think anything less than 18 months seems, you know, unless there's like a specific reason, I'm not sure I would do that. I hear a lot of people say 24 is fine, you know, and, you know, 18, 24, that's about that.
I think 18, I mean, in our pitch deck to LPs, we say, you know, we try to adhere to certain kind of rules, and rule 10 is break rules 1 through 9. But, you know, one of the rules is like, invest in rounds where it provides a minimum of 18 months runway. And if there's a market correction and things get a little bit nuclear winter out there, 18 becomes 24. And it's hard to get, you know, it's hard to do more than that because of the reason that people don't want to sell too much stock while it's cheap. And so you tend to be there. I find with like really seed spicy deals where they're raising small amounts of money, it might be hard to get an 18 month runway. And in fact, if you really are sticking to that 18-month runway with discipline, which we tend to do, that's part of what's pushing us out of that early stage deal, as opposed to it didn't have enough revenue or whatever, because they are racing for under. They kind of have that safe note in their back pocket or convertible note in their back pocket, and they're raising money before and after lunch, kind of continuous fundraising, drip financing. Well, and you know, talk about graduation rates. Being in the Valley where everyone's an angel has got to be easier than, you know, the richest guy, you know, he's like, sorry, I just don't do that. You know, I don't invest in private companies. You know, I can redeem out of my hedge funds, but I don't do that. You know, whereas most people have some conviction.
Like out on the lacrosse field, you know, if you had a company that was doing well and, you know, you wanted to talk about it, there'd be two or three of the other, you know, parents who are like, oh yeah, we look at those kinds of deals. What? And so, you know, if you wanted to turn your 18-month runway into 24 and, you know, six-figure checks were going to be, you know, you pull together a few of them, it was going to be what enabled you to go from 18 to 24. Super easy to do.
Especially if you're bringing good people into the orbit of the company. Like this is additive person, you know, she ran big data at Yahoo or something. Like you're like, I would give her stock. And the fact that she's paying in for it is great. It's certainly not dead weight.
That's Nirvana. Yeah. But even if it's just a check, there's nothing wrong.
Yeah, that is true. You know, as long as they're not Al Qaeda and the check didn't bounce,
they're not a negative, right? They're not active in a net deleterious fashion. Oh, we want to do a weekly blah 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 blah.
Strangle the company to death. Yeah. A good VC is one that doesn't destroy value, is a common expression.
One other big thing, I, you know, in terms of the Series A. So, you know, people will focus on, oh, the median Series A is 13-ish or 14 or 12 or whatever the number is.
Numbers are you saying for medium C, median A?
12, 13. But the important point is there's a huge dispersion. And I actually pulled the numbers this morning. For the last 3 months in the United States, the median at seed is $2.51 million round, and the median Series A is 13.0. Okay, yeah, like that hasn't changed that much. But the dispersion around that is so big. But if you look at the 25th and 75th percentile. So we're talking the middle half of it. At seed, it goes from 704K up to 4.6 million. So that's like a factor of four, whatever that, six.
Yeah.
I think it's big range. And for Series A, where the median is 13, the 25th to 75th percentile is 9.2 million to 22.5 million. So the middle half of all financings is this gigantic swath from 9.2 to 22.5 million. And so when people say, oh, it's the $13 million, and they say, well, we want to do a median series, like, what?
Companies are different.
You know what the company needs, and then find the right investors for whom writing a $9 million, check is the right amount.
Also, like, I generally say, like, you know, we've made money in hardware before. We've done hardware investing, and we've learned it's hard. And I generally say, like, if there's hardware in this thing, and you're dealing with supply chain, there's a whole bunch of things beyond your control. Mistakes are more punishing than like a wireless service book to fix something or, you know, update a website. So I tend to say you might need a longer runway than, and you might be willing to take that dilution. You might, you know, what's my budget, double it kind of stuff. Like that home extension, redoing your kitchen is going to take twice as long, cost twice as much.
Yeah.
You know, there's less to be waiting. There may even be fewer investors that you could introduce them to that are willing to do that. You know, so in some industries, it's a crash of the stock market, you know, could be even harder. What are some irreversible decisions that are, you know, or mistakes that you commonly see? Like, what's the face tattoo mistake that you don't want to do in all of this with all of your experience, Eric?
My number one piece of advice is plan ahead. I like so often. And, you know, not with the companies that I'm investing in because I'm on them to not do this. But so often I see my friends and fellow seed investors say, I've got a company that's raising Series A. And here's our target investor list. Do you know anybody? And you just go, are you kidding me? Right? Like, why didn't you spend the last 6 months putting together not just the name of the firm, but who's the right partner at the firm?
Right, fact, right.
Before you even did that, why didn't you figure out whether you're raising $5 or $10 or $20 million? Because what you're raising drives what the right firm is. So the firm size, like there are great firms who would write a $5 or $6 million Series A check. And there are great firms that would only write a $30 million Series A check. They're different. And so if you haven't done that homework ahead of time, to figure out how much you're looking to raise, identify the right firms, identify the partner at the firm who is a good fit for you. And the litmus test I always use is, if you can't look in the mirror and say why that partner is a good fit for your firm, for your company that you're raising for, then they're probably not one you should be pitching, right? You should be looking to get the very best investors you possibly can, and you want to work with the people who can add value. These are unlike your seed investors. The Series A person is going to sit on your board of directors for the next 8 years, right? This is a long-term marriage. You want to love that person, not just tolerate them. So that's the other thing. They just don't prepare ahead of time. And they'll come out with a crazy list. They'll come out like, we want to pitch to Benchmark and Sequoia and Union Square and blah, you know, and fantastic. Like they just list the top 10 firms. Like, oh, fantastic firms, but do they invest in your category? Have you taken the time to find out who the partner is, who's the right lead for an investment into your company? And usually the answer is no. Can you introduce us to somebody?
It's just, so target account, target investor list was not properly researched or constructed, is a mistake, and it just results in you're not a fit. I think that, you know, the company itself is a moving target. So, you know, there might be an investor who says, oh, we only invest in companies with 10 million revenue. We only invest in companies with 1 million revenue, whatever it is, that sometimes it's worth socializing to some of these before you move out of their, you know, out of their zone. And like, but like, I like the idea of saying like, well, you know, we could, you know, just go straight into a Series A, or we could get diluted at a lower valuation for a smaller amount of money with some good people. The runway is not bad. And that puts us in a much stronger footing to go after that A round. I mean, some people think I'm just trying to get my money in it at a lower valuation, but sometimes that's the right thing to do, is especially if you get along with the investor and you think that investor can bring a whole lot of customers or help you build out a sales team or something that you don't have that experience or skill set, on board. And before we wind up, valuation is just one important thing of many things. In a price round, you have a whole lot of other terms, and we don't have time to do a whole episode on it because we're going to wrap up in a minute here. But you don't see a lot of governance in a SafeNote. You don't see a lot of other preferred major investor rights that are defined, like pro rata equity rights and information rights and voting rights, even in a convertible note. What are your thoughts around what is important for investors and what's important for founders on these other terms? And do you use a side letter agreement to kind of build some of that back in when you're doing safe notes and convertible note investing?
Yeah. I mean, like many professional investors, I care about my pro rata rights and my information rights. And so I do have a standard side letter for that. It's, I start with a Y Combinator one. I mean, it's fine. So for an institutionalized seed investor, some of them care about that, some don't. I do. And so I want to know what's going on with my companies. And so I do that. When it comes to the governance and being close to the companies, I think it's a different undertaking when I was writing a $20 million check into a late stage round, then the care and even in the downside case, right? If you can get 20% of your money back versus 0% of your money back, does justify, full-time effort of a highly paid person for quite a bit of months, that totally makes sense. When it's a $500,000 investment at the earliest stages where we're not going to be on the board and we are counting on the company making progress and us helping sort of hand the baton on to the next investor, then the downside protection issues and aspects and governance aspects become a lot less important. It's just not part of the model as much.
Got it. Well, cool. Well, listen, great talking to you. Thanks for sharing your wisdom and even some of this research. I'll get your link to the blog when you post it into the show notes. So, as soon as that's available, send me a quick message so I do that immediately. And thanks for taking the time. Look forward to co-investing with you more, man.
Thank you for having me on, Andrew. It's been a real fun time.
Okay, bye for now.